This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. This is Rick Chicago, also known as Earthplay. The People Speak Radio Show normally airs every Tuesday night, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate in our show. We'll call in questions for our guests at the bottom of the hour in the U.S. and Canada by dialing 1-888-429-5471. You can also join us in our virtual radio room auditorium on Paltalk, paltalk.com, at the People Speak Radio Show and category of special issues. Tonight, we have a very special guest with us. We have Arne Gunderson, nuclear engineer and energy expert, holds nuclear safety patents, licensed reactor operator, former nuclear industry senior vice president, and the accolades could go on and on. Welcome, Arne. Do we have you with us tonight, Arne? Hello.
Hey, Arne Gunderson's still here.
Hi, welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. Great to have you.
Thanks, Rick.
Boy, we have a can full of worms to open up here tonight, Arne. Fukushima and the nuclear industry. We seem to have kind of a lot of inexplicable natural disasters afflicting our planet right now. Can you take us back and kind of walk us through what happened at Fukushima and where we are today?
Yeah, that's a great question to start. We'll probably go on for hours, but yeah. What happened there was an earthquake off the coast of Japan, and you know Japan is riddled with earthquake faults. It's the worst place in the world to build a nuclear power plant. It's got high population density, and it's got cracks in the earth everywhere. But they did, and they had prior warnings that a large tsunami could come in. There's records in history of tsunamis as high as 120 feet. And against those records in history, when the people built Fukushima Daiichi, they built a 12-foot high tsunami wall. So, you know, a 12-foot high tsunami wall doesn't stop many tsunamis. And so a tsunami came in after the earthquake. The plant shut down. The earthquake shut the plant down. And likely one of the units was in trouble, but not all four from the earthquake. And then when the tsunami hit, it not only flooded the diesels, you know, that's the story of that everybody hears,
right?
But it also knocked out the cooling pumps along the water. And, you know, it's like the water pump in your car. When you lose a hose to your water pump, your engine seizes up, and right. The diesels would have gone one way or the other. So without electricity, they couldn't cool the plant. You know, what happens in a nuclear reactor is that when the uranium splits, only 93% of the power is generated there. The other 7% comes from those pieces, the radioactive rubble that's left behind. And that doesn't sound like much, 7%, but when you've got 4 million horsepower, you're trying to cool 260 or 280,000 horsepower of heat, and you get a meltdown. So, you know, but it could have been a lot worse. The amazing thing that the press has not even thought about is that the tsunami hit at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, and they had about 1,000 people on site. Had the tsunami hit at 2 o'clock in the morning, there would have been 100 people on site. All the managers would have been gone. And we would have had 10 meltdowns in Japan, not three. So, you know, in a way, it could have been an awful lot worse.
Wow, that's pretty scary. And what kind of a reactor was this now? Was it a breeder reactor? Was it strictly for electricity? Were they producing plutonium? And what is MOX fuel?
Yeah, it was made by General Electric in a California company. You know, when I was a young engineer, I spent a lot of time out in San Jose, which is where General Electric built this reactor. And it was designed by an engineering company in Manhattan. So it's an American design from the 60s that finally went online in 71, 72, and 73. There's a couple of them that went on about a year or two apart. So it's essentially an ancient reactor design. You know, Maggie and I were walking one day about 3 weeks before the disaster. And she asked me, she said, you know, we do all these expert reports and we keep finding all these problems all around the world. Where do you think the next disaster is going to be? And I said, I don't know where, but I know it's going to be in a General Electric reactor. And
I saw a video of you and Maggie discussing that exact same thing recently.
Yeah, it's the real deal. So now what happened, you asked about plutonium and MOX fuel.
Yes.
When a reactor starts with about 5% uranium-235 and 95% uranium-238, but over its 18-month life, some of that uranium-238 becomes plutonium. So every nuclear reactor has about 1,000 pounds of plutonium inside it because of the U-238 absorbing a neutron and becoming plutonium-239. But the Unit 3, Fukushima Daiichi Unit 3, in addition to that plutonium, actually had plutonium fuel. And, of course, it was the most damaged, the colossal detonation that blew it up into over 2 miles high.
That was a release of hydrogen, right?
Well, I don't think so. I still think it was a problem, something we call a prompt moderated criticality. But I think something happened in the fuel pool. But the key is, regardless of what caused it, there's not a containment in the world that could withstand that kind of a pressure wave. It's like, you know, you watch these guys split a board with their hand. And when your hand is moving very fast, you can shatter the board. And that's what happened. This shock wave was traveling at supersonic speeds and shattered the building. And we don't know why. You know, the engineering community and the technical community doesn't know why it happened, but we do know that every reactor in that world would explode in a similar fashion if it were to happen. And that's a scary place to be. You know, if you don't know what caused it, and you know if it happens again, you're going to blow your reactor to smithereens. That's
so. Reactors were completely destroyed?
Well, yes. The containment buildings, first off, the reactor is like a pressure cooker. It sits in the middle of another building called the containment building. And the containment buildings were designed for maybe 40 pounds of pressure. And they hit over 100 pounds of pressure. And they were designed for 200 or 300 degrees, and they hit 700 degrees. So the containment buildings cracked and bent and bowed, and the bolts shattered, and the electrical connections melted. So what you've got now is a molten nuclear reactor core that melted out of the pressure cooker, out of the reactor,
right,
onto the floor of the containment. And whether or not it made it through the floor into the groundwater, to my mind, doesn't really matter. Because there's so many holes in the containment, the groundwater's coming in. And so it doesn't matter if it's gotten out, if the groundwater's getting in. And, of course, now it's contaminating the Pacific Ocean.
And that's being also compounded by water flowing under the mountain and under the reactors themselves physically?
Yeah. You know, the site, when it was originally chosen by the American engineers, that mountain was about 120 feet higher. And they cut it down to make the nuclear plant get closer to the ocean. And in the process, you know, when you cut a mountain down and you've got all this underwater, underground streams and all that stuff, They essentially opened up the mountain so that all those underground streams are now flowing into the site and directly into the nuclear reactor.
Now, there has been a lot of talk about these ice walls and these ice dams. And as a matter of fact, it was headline news today, I believe, on E&E. And didn't they come out a year and a half ago and say that the ice wall was a failure because they realized that the nuclear contaminated water would not freeze? Why are we still hearing this?
It's not working. They built the ice wall anyway, even though they, you're right, a year and a half ago, there were concerns that it wouldn't work. And it's leaking. So we've got this ice wall now, and they've discovered that still 50 tons a day of radioactive water are getting through it. And that makes a lot of other problems. You know, there's this law of unintended consequences. So they build this ice wall. And what that can easily do is raise the water table on site. And this nuclear plant can then start to settle unevenly. So if there's another earthquake, and now it's essentially in jello instead of in hard earth.
You have a slow motion liquefaction going on there.
You've got it. You've got it exactly.
Now, you mentioned here a couple of moments ago about the fuel rods that are replaced every 18 months or so on average in every nuclear power plant in the world?
Yeah. About a third of the nuclear power plant fuel is changed out every 18 months. And so over 5 years, you remove all of the fuel, 18, 18, and 18, yeah.
And there are radioactive releases in this process, is that right?
Oh, God, yeah. First off, the fuel, the fuel pool at Fukushima Daiichi had the equivalent of 700 nuclear warheads worth of cesium in it. So when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission told Americans to stay away by 50 miles, they were concerned about all of this radioactivity in the fuel pool. And then in addition, though, there's radioactivity in the water and gases and things like that. So when you shut the nuclear reactor down, you're giving off radioactivity as well. But the big source is this fuel, and that's sitting in a fuel pool. And that's dangerous all around the world.
Now, you were a nuclear engineer, a plant operator at one time. So now, it is my understanding that when a fuel rod is removed from the reactor as a used rod, that they're only a million times more toxic than before it went into the reactor. Could you explain that?
Oh, it might even be a billion times more toxic than when it went. New fuel is essentially dirt. You know, it's uranium that's found in the soil. And you can go up and you put a Geiger counter on it and it will click. But it's essentially a rock. But once it runs through the nuclear reactor, the uranium splits. And this rubble is highly, highly radioactive, and it's physically hot. So, you know, if you put the individual pellet is about the size of the first joint in your pinky. And if you put that pellet on the desk in front of you, you'd be dead in less than a minute.
Geez, that's unfathomable. So the water that the used fuel rods are stored in have got to be building a level of toxicity that we probably will never hear about, but you're the right person to ask. So how are they doing this, containing all this toxicity, or do they change the water, or what's going on here?
Yeah, first off, the nuclear fuel, if you don't have a nuclear disaster, the nuclear fuel is pretty pretty rigid and doesn't leak too much. It will leak a little bit, but not a lot. But of course, when you have a disaster like Daiichi, all bets are off. But the fuel pool has a filter, like a swimming pool filter, but it's better. And that's how you get that crystal clear water. So those filters are removed every couple of days, and they're shipped to a dump here in the U.S. They're shipped to a dump in Texas and There's a few other dumps around the country, but maybe once a week, the swimming pool filter gets replaced, and a new filter media gets put in. That's how they keep the water as crystal clear as it is.
Now, what is going on with the fuel rods in the pools above the reactors at Fukushima? We see the buildings were bowed out. They're falling apart, disintegrating. The steel structures are twisted. So what are the state of those fuel rods? Has there already been a pyrophoric and nuclear fire that has burned that fuel out and allowed it to fall into the sub-chambers of what was left of the reactor building? Or what is the status of that fuel now? We had trying to move them out.
If there had been a fuel pool fire, one fuel pool, it would have cut Japan in half. It would have been a 50-mile no man's land, there would be northern Japan and southern Japan, but the middle of Japan would be unoccupied. That's how much radiation is in that fuel pool. As long as you keep them underwater, you won't get a pyrophoric fire.
That was just one pool?
That's just one pool. So, if you look at the worst case of the tsunami happening at night, like we started the hour with, we would have had 10 pools in meltdown. And, that would have been horrendous for the entire northern hemisphere.
Okay. Speaking of the northern hemisphere, what the hell is going on here, Arnie? Month after month after month, we get these headlines of atrocious animal die-offs, beaches littered from Baja, Mexico, and probably even further, and up to Alaska. They have put off limits the Kenai Peninsula for clamming. Now the salmon industry, the tuna industry, sardine industry, they have all collapsed along the West Coast. The animals are emaciated, starving, dying, all kinds of diseases. And it seems like I just read this last month, tens of thousands wash up. Then the next week, tens of thousands wash up. And now this week, the largest wash up ever recorded in history. How much is Fukushima contributing to this mass extinction and what's going on in the Atlantic? I know it may be a little bit out of your wheelhouse, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I do. You know, the Pacific is a big place. And so what's coming out of Fukushima Daiichi, by the time it gets to 5,000 miles across the Pacific, it gets diluted. But we're still seeing what I would call significant amounts of radiation in the ocean water. It's called 10 becquerels per cubic meter. A cubic meter is like a yard by a yard by a yard. And inside that block, if you imagine 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, there would be 10 disintegrations every second. And that would go on for 300 years, because that's how long this radiation stands. And, of course, the fish are swimming through it. So no one is measuring these fish for radiation. And we also know the Pacific's getting warmer, and we got all this chemical pollution and plastic pollution and stuff like that out there too. But we do know that radiation is an immunosuppressant. And you can be sure that Fukushima's contribution to this problem is not helping it any. It's making it worse.
Oh, boy. So what is safe about nuclear energy? They tell you that it's safe, that it's clean, that it's abundant, that it's renewable. And here's was a statement that I became aware of today from one of our chat participants, that the NRC states that nobody has ever died from radiation.
Yeah, that's what the NRC states. First off, I got out of college in 1971 with my bachelor's in nuclear. I hung around for another year and got a master's in nuclear. And that's when this wave of nuclear plants was being commissioned, brought online. And America brought about 100 plants online between 1970 and 1990. There really haven't been any since then. Matter of fact, we've closed 20. We had 120 nukes, and 20 are already closed. So anyway, at the time I was building them, and I was part of the problem back 40 years ago, at the time I was building them, there was no talk about carbon buildup in the atmosphere and no global warming. That's all a marketing ploy by the nuclear industry now. The issue was the energy shortage. You know, we had the gas lines and things like that.
Right.
And the nukes were built because we thought we were running out of energy. Well, that didn't happen. And Forbes magazine, which is a very conservative business magazine, said building all of those nukes in the 70s and 80s was the biggest managerial disaster in the history of American industry. So it was a bad idea. And now we've got 100 of these bad ideas scattered all over the country. There's 23, just like Fukushima Daiichi, in the United States. Of the 100 in the United States, 23 are mirror images of what we've got over in Fukushima.
That's really comforting, Arnie.
So, you know, you hear the issues of they help global warming and things like that. They were never built with that in mind, and that's really the last-ditch argument of the nuclear industry.
Well, 100 of these nuclear power plants, I was startled that they provide 30% or less of the nation's country. We were all under the impression you build one or two of these bad boys will run a whole state for, you know, a century.
Yeah. You know, these 100 plants make about 19% of our electricity, but our electricity is only a third of our total energy. You know, we heat our houses with gas or whatever, and we drive our cars with gasoline. So the total energy, nukes are a drop in the bucket. They're, you know, about 6 or 7% of America's total energy use is being provided for by nukes. And worldwide, it's only 2%. So, yeah, you hear that there's 400 nuclear power plants saving the day. But in fact, with all of the uses, not just electricity, but home heating and transportation and industrial uses, nukes only contribute about 2% worldwide. And we take the risk of another Fukushima every day.
And we still don't even know what to do with the toxic waste that has been occurring now for 65 years, longer.
Yeah, you know, I gave a speech out at Northwestern University in Chicago last year. And the quote that there was a Forbes reporter there who quoted me. And I've never had something go viral before. But my quote on that was that the nuclear industry would have you believe that mankind is smart enough that they can store nuclear waste for 250,000 years. But at the same time, they'd have you believe that mankind is so dumb, we can't store solar electricity overnight. And that's really the Achilles heel here. You know, even if there are no disasters, first off, it's expensive. Second off, you're bound to have a disaster about every decade or two. And then on top of that, what do you do with the waste at the end? And it's a legacy that you're leaving to not just your kids or your grandkids, but, you know, 70 generations worth of children are going to live with the legacy of it.
That these accidents are so rare that we would only have like one accident every couple of centuries. And yet I have a list here of 45 accidents, serious accidents worldwide.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. You know, in my professional career, we had a meltdown at Three Mile Island, a meltdown at Chernobyl, and three meltdowns at Fukushima. So in 40 years, we've got five meltdowns, and that's about one every 8 years. And then you're right, though, if you look at worldwide, even in the U.S., if we can look at Santa Susana, which was a serious government cover-up in 1959, there was a meltdown about 40 miles outside of L.A.
Yes.
And we're still finding radioactivity in people's vacuum cleaner bags 20 and 30 miles away from Santa Susana. So right. the radiation that was given off from that disaster in 1959 is still wandering into people's houses even now. And it goes on. So you're right. There's been dozens of nuclear disasters. Just the five meltdowns of my career are the end of the process. You know, what's happening is this. It's that the distance between meltdowns is getting longer. But the when they melt down, they're much worse. So the frequency is decreasing, but the consequences are increasing. And that's a pretty miserable place to find yourself.
Wow. Let me see if I can get back into our window here. Hi, Sonic.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I used to work at that plant over there, the GE plant over by the cemetery there. I know what you're talking about. I was wondering if you could explain the reality of the China syndrome, if you could give us a little more light about what we can expect out of this disaster.
Yeah, that's a great question. No, that's a term they don't teach in engineering school. That's first, there's three phases. There's a meltdown. And think of a nuclear reactor as a pressure cooker. And inside that pressure cooker is nuclear fuel. And there's thousands of rods that are 12 feet long, but they're in an array that's only about 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet. So, and in that 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet, so essentially a bedroom that's 12 feet high, they've got 4 million horsepower of heat. So when things go wrong, things go really, really wrong, and the nuclear fuel melts. So that's called a meltdown. Then it lays on the bottom of the pressure cooker, of the nuclear reactor. And at Daiichi, it was so hot that it melted through the nuclear reactor. So we have a meltdown where the fuel melts and lays on the reactor floor. And then when the floor gives way, the nuclear fuel falls out. And that's called a melt through. So now you've got this blob of essentially molten lava lying on the bottom of the nuclear reactor containment. And that's concrete. And over time, it eats its way through the concrete because it's so physically hot. Now, at Daiichi, there's about 4 feet of concrete underneath the containment. And at Daiichi, it probably ate its way down 2 or 3 feet. But there, nobody knows. First off, it may have left the containment. We don't know because there's no photograph of it. But the odds are it's still inside the containment. But so this blob melts its way into the concrete and through the concrete. And when it gets through the concrete, that's called a China syndrome because the joke was that it would burrow its way from America over to China. It would melt its way through. But that's really all three of those, meltdown, melt through, and China syndrome, are not technical terms, but they really describe what happened. So now you've got Daiichi with this blob of probably 100 tons of plutonium and uranium and lots of other nasty isotopes lying on the floor. But the groundwater is coming in. So it doesn't matter if the core has melted into the groundwater. The containment is leaking like a sieve and the water's coming in. So one way or the other, you've got effectively the problems you'd encounter with a melt, with a China syndrome. You know, you've got nuclear radioactive material in contact with the groundwater. And that it happens to have stayed in the containment doesn't matter because the containment's leaking like a sieve. Did I answer that for you?
Arnie. Yeah, that's fantastic. Thanks so much. I'll listen to back on the Pow Talk injury. Thank you.
Thanks.
Arnie, what happens when it does melt through and melt down into the strata? It comes in contact with an aquifer or maybe one of those volcanic fault lines.
Well, you know, it over time, it gets cooler. In the first day, there's 7% or a quarter of a million horsepower of heat. On the second day, there's like 1%. On the third day, there's like 0.5%. So if the meltdown doesn't happen in the first 3, 4, 5 days, the odds are it's going to get trapped on the floor.
Are now, you talking about the elephant foot?
Yeah, that's right. The elephant foot at Chernobyl is an example of that. That was a meltdown, and it was a melt through the nuclear fuel. And for your listeners, if you just go up and Google elephant's foot, you'll see the nuclear core at Chernobyl, and it melted down into the basement of the building, but it stopped. And the reason it stopped is that over time, the decay heat from all of this radioactive rubble gets less and less and less. And if you can hold the thing together for 4 or 5 days, the odds are it's not going to make it into an aquifer.
Okay. Now, what about these reports of cesium-131 and these other elements that are, there's literally hundreds of these elements bleeding out of Fukushima every minute of every day, and they talk about these half-lives of eight and a half days. Well, how relevant are these numbers if the leaking is ongoing?
Yeah, there's a couple of nasty isotopes that are leaking out every day, and the worst two are cesium and strontium. And cesium has two isotopes, 137 and 134. And 134 has a 2-year half-life. So in about 20 years, it will be completely gone. But 137 has a 30-year half-life. So it's going to be around for 300 years. Or the general rule is 10 half-lives. But the same with the strontium. Strontium is the thing they're not measuring, and it's the big... the big secret in Japan is why aren't they looking at the strontium? Strontium is a bone seeker. Yeah. It behaves just like calcium. So when you know, it's in your teeth, it's in your bones, and it causes all sorts of nasty leukemias. That's got a 30-year half-life, and that's leaking out every day. And we're not even looking for that in the Pacific. And that's a concern of mine, is that strontium is called an HTD. That stands for a hard to detect. It's easy to see cesium. You can pick it up with an inspector or Geiger counter. But you can't pick up strontium. So the Japanese are measuring the radiation with their handheld Geiger counters, and they think that's all there is. But in fact, there's twice as much as what they're measuring, because they're not detecting the strontium. And that's the biggest issue there is the kids. I'm an old guy. If I get some radioactive cesium in me, and I was there for a month in February. I was in Japan for a month.
Last month, right?
If I get cesium in me, the odds are that I'll get cancer 20 years out, and I'll be 87 years old, and something else will have killed me by then. But the sin is that the kids are exposed to this stuff, and their cells are rapidly dividing, and a kid is 10 times, and girls are 20 times more radiosensitive than adults. I've been suggesting for years now that bringing the children back into Fukushima Prefecture is unconscionable.
Yeah, even having them in Japan. Now, Arnie, I see you as a straight-shooting, honest guy. What is going on with the Japanese government? They won't allow doctors to even admit to their patients that they've been irradiated. They're being put out of business. They're being silenced. They're being put in jail. Have you personally been a witness to any of this or been threatened by the government? And why are they keeping it quiet?
Yeah, well, first off, it is true that the Japanese government is intimidating doctors. When I was over there, for 30 days at the halfway through February into March, and I met with doctors who said what is happening is that if they get a patient that's, their hair is falling out and they got a bloody nose and they got splotches all over them, if they diagnose that as radiation sickness, the government doesn't pay. If they diagnose it as stress, the government does pay. So I met doctors who actually had to close their business down because they were diagnosing people with radiation illnesses. So the pressure on doctors to behave appropriately in the Japanese culture is enormous. And of course, now we're not getting any decent epidemiological data because all the doctors' reports are showing, you know, stress and not radiation related. So why is the key? When the disaster happened, there's 10 big utilities in Japan, and they have incredible control over the diet, and the diet is like the parliament or the Congress. It's the people's house, and those 10 utilities run the diet. And so what happened is these 50 nuclear plants went offline, and the banks kept loaning money to the utilities to pay for a staff of 700 people to not do anything for 5 years. So you paid 700 people's salaries for 5 years, and now the banks want their money back.
Well,
and
course.
So, yeah, it's all about, it's following the money. You know, the banks and the utilities are putting enormous pressure on the Japanese diet to get these plants started again and to shut up the doctors who have a conscience. The inhumanity of the Japanese government to its own people was one of the takeaways from my trip. Was the gross inhumanity of the Japanese government to their own people was just unconscionable.
It's atrocious, immoral, should be illegal. Arnie, stay with us. We have to take our one and only break. You're listening to the People Speak radio program. I am your host, Rick Chicago, and we're here with Arnie Gunnison, nuclear engineer, and we'll be right back, folks.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Okay, welcome back to the People Speak radio program here on bbsradio.com. This is Rick Chicago in Albuquerque, and we're talking today with Arnie Gunnison from fairwinds.org. Now, you got to spell that right. It's fairewinds.org, fairwinds.org. Welcome back, Arnie.
Hey, I'm having fun. Thanks for having me.
Oh, by the way, I love your clock.
I'm sorry.
I love it. I do. So we have a lot of questions to get through, and we only have about 15 minutes left, the producer is telling me, so we'll get through some of these. But I want to direct people over to fairwinds.org so that they can start educating themselves, because the questions are going to start getting a little bit harder.
Okay. Well, yeah, thank you for mentioning the site. And, you know, it's really, people think of me as being fervent, but really it was Maggie's, my wife's idea, and she's really the strategic. She understands the power of the internet much more than I do.
Yeah, tell us about your site. I understand that you could even type in a question and you'll try to answer it back.
Yeah, there's a an info question link, and we try to answer every question. I'm sure we don't get all of them, but if somebody has an unanswered question, they can send it through, and over the next couple of days, we'll try to respond.
Now, you have podcasts over there. Do you have interviews? And I understand you've been on Nuclear Hot Seat with Libby Halevi, Jeff Rentz, and a lot of other programs. Just a whole list here. Can they find that over at fairwinds.org?
Yeah, almost every video we've ever done is on the site. And we started right after Fukushima Daiichi. I was CNN's expert during the disaster. And so all of the old CNN videos are there as well. My God, I don't claim to be prescient. I don't claim to have some crystal ball that can see the future, but I just tell the future like it is. And an example is when the accident happened, the head of the Department of Energy, a guy named Secretary Chu, was on, and he said, "Oh, it's not any worse than Three Mile Island." And then CNN got to me, and I said, "Baloney! This is as bad as Chernobyl, and could get worse. Could be Chernobyl on steroids." And so our government and the Japanese were trying to cover it up from the very get-go.
Okay. Our question here comes from Matt in Corrales. Do you think the situation at Fukushima will get worse before things get better?
You know, let's compare Fukushima to Chernobyl. There's three different types of releases that come out of a nuclear plant after a meltdown. And the first is something called noble gases, xenon and krypton. Fukushima released three times more noble gases than Chernobyl. And a matter of fact, in Seattle, the noble gas concentrations were 400,000 times higher than normal. That's how bad it was. But that's behind us, though that's already been released. What's on the ground now is cesium and strontium on the ground. But compared, and likely Fukushima and Chernobyl have roughly the same amount, maybe Fukushima a little bit less on the ground. But what's different about Fukushima is that the amount of radiation that's leaking into the ocean is probably 100 or 1,000 times more than what Chernobyl ever released. And that's not stopping. So to answer his question, I don't think they know how to stop that groundwater. We've been approached by drilling engineers that work for petrochemical companies that are in the oil extraction business. And they have techniques to seal that site up. And the Japanese are not paying any attention to them. So if it's not invented here, they don't seem to want to do it. And we do crazy things like build ice walls. So I think the liquid releases are going to get worse before they get better.
Why isn't the international community bringing any weight against them? They have the Olympics coming up pretty soon, and they expect us to believe everything is fine and we should go over there?
You know, I was one of 17 scientists that wrote to Ban Ki-moon, and Ban Ki-moon is the head of the UN, and we urged him to get the international community involved. And not just the guys that are pro-nuke, but the people that are the independent experts like me, and there are others. And it went nowhere. I don't know why, but the Japanese are very resistant to outside experts helping them solve the problem. And it's to everybody's advantage, whether you're pro-nuke or anti-nuke. You want to solve this problem. You don't want to contaminate the Pacific any more than it's already contaminated. And yet they don't do it, and that's a frustration of mine.
Okay, next question is from Roger in Rio Rancho, who asks, honestly, have we been irradiated, and how seriously?
I don't know where Rio Rancho is, but
it's in New Mexico.
Okay. the Pacific Northwest received significant radiation right after the disaster. We've been able to detect more than just measurable, reasonable amounts of radiation as far north as Vancouver and as far south as Northern California. So what happened was the radioactive gases blew across the Pacific, and when they hit the Rocky Mountains, it rained out on the Pacific coastline. In Seattle, we've already measured. We had radiation detectors on the ground in Seattle. And the average person in Seattle was breathing in 10 hot particles a day in March and April.
Yes.
Yeah, so the short answer is yes, in those areas. You know, as you get on the other side of the Rocky Mountains, and if you head further south, there's some that you might be able to measure, but not an awful lot.
Okay, this one comes from Love is Light in North Carolina. Are our gardens safe with rain on our gardens, and what should people do to protect themselves, children, and food from radiation?
You're not going to be able to measure the radiation in your garden vegetables with a handheld Geiger counter. The devices that do that cost about $10,000. So if you walk out to your garden and you put an inspector radiation detector on and your tomato doesn't register anything, it doesn't mean it's clean. It means that the detector can't pick it up. But, when I compare, except for areas that were directly in the plume, which is that Pacific Northwest, except for those areas, I compare the other stuff that's in vegetables now, and the fertilizers and the GMO issues, and I would say that the radiation in those foods is the least of my worries. Now that said, I don't eat fish that comes from the Pacific anymore. That's a personal choice that I've made because my government's screwing me. They're not telling me what's in that fish. And until the government goes out and measures how much radiation and publishes it, I've chosen not to eat fish from the Pacific.
Hey, this question may or may not be relevant, but Mike in Paradise, California asks, who do you like in this election cycle, and which one of these candidates is likely to make a difference in nuclear industry?
Yeah, Fairwinds cannot be political. As a nonprofit,
right,
we really can't be political. I have a personal opinion, but I can't. When I get in a voting box and push a click, there is a candidate who I vote for, but that's I can't claim that it represents my professional.
Respect that. Now, Tex in Houston is asking here: are there any long-term solutions? Obviously, the Japanese don't listen to anybody, but do you see any long-term solutions here?
Yeah, what I would do is stop the water. And I think the drilling technology from the oil business is the best way. Stop the water and then fill those buildings with concrete and walk away for 100 years. And after 100 years, the radiation will be 10 times lower. What they're trying to do now is go charging into these highly radioactive buildings, and they're irradiating thousands of young Japanese men. And that's not good for the gene pool. There's so many men that are becoming irradiated. In my opinion, let's do what they're doing with Chernobyl. They've put a lid over it and walked away for 100 years. Why do we think Fukushima should be handled any differently than Chernobyl? So I have said since 2012, seal the water, keep the water out, which means then it doesn't go into the Pacific, and then walk away for 100 years before you ever try to clean it up. The Japanese government doesn't want to do that, though, because they want to show people that they can solve this problem so they can run these other 50 nukes. So it's really about showing the population that nuclear can be controlled.
But isn't it more honest to say that they don't have a clue as how to deal with this corium?
You know, I wrote the book on decommissioning back in 1980, and this is not in the book. There's nothing in the books that talks about how to deal with this. We're not in engineering here. We're in science, and nobody has developed any techniques. We don't even know where it is or what it looks like.
That's atrocious. A serious question here. Honestly, will humanity survive the nuclear age, Arnie?
You know, what frightens me is what could have happened in Japan, and that could have been catastrophic for the Northern Hemisphere. You know, if a tsunami happens between 2 o'clock in the afternoon when there's 1,000 people and 2 o'clock at night when there's 100 people, it could have been disastrous for the Northern Hemisphere. And I go to bed at night hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping, you know, I could think of another half a dozen ways that nuclear plants could fail. And I just hope that I'm wrong. My biggest fear right now is the earthquakes here in the States, Indian Point, which is just north of New York City, and Diablo Canyon, which is out in California, are huge earthquake risks. And then, of course, none of these plants were designed to protect us from terrorists. So the terrorism threat is something that could be a game changer.
So will humanity survive the nuclear age, yes or no?
Oh, God, I hope so. I guess I'm still an optimist, you know?
Okay. We're coming down to the last couple of minutes here, Arnie. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, and I want to invite you back to a future date, if that's okay.
Yeah, we'd love to. Thank you.
Is there anything you would like to share with our audience that you would like to have said that you didn't, or some resources or your websites, books, or anything you'd like to talk about?
Well, the only book I publish is in Japanese, so unless you're a Japanese reader, we'll forget about that. But yeah, please go to the Fairwind site. You know, back before the disaster at Daiichi, we had 40 people a day go to the site. And after I was on CNN, we had 25,000 a day go to the site. So it's a really good site with lots of resources. So I really would recommend people do that. We do try to answer questions if you have them.
That's a man clock if I ever heard one in my life. That's
sorry.
Remember the fairwinds.org. One last question. Is talking about Fukushima fear porn, Arnie?
I don't think so. I think it's, you know, if you don't talk about the reality of what's going on there, you got your head in the sand.
Yeah. I really detest the way that they're changing the words of the English language, that you're not significantly being radiated, you know, changing terms, downplaying the seriousness in media by using these little buzzwords and phrases just kind of drives me up the wall.
Yeah, and I see the and on top of that, you know, the independent experts are, you know, personally attacked. Maggie and I have been, you know, personally attacked for years, and it's sad when voices of truth are silenced.
Doesn't it come down to a matter of money over the lives and the welfare and the safety of the people? I mean, it appears to me the Japanese are being extremely reckless with their population and ours as well.
Yeah, you know, we've got 23 plants exactly like Fukushima Daiichi, including a whole bunch right near Chicago. And we never even thought of closing them down and reevaluating whether they should run or not. And in the big picture, like we were talking about at the beginning of the hour, they're a drop in the bucket compared to the total energy. But if one of them goes wrong, you've changed the fabric of society for generations. Is that a risk that's worth taking? And my answer is no.
So what changed you from being pro-nuclear to going out and being a whistleblower? Oh, I'm sorry, Arnie. We're out of time. We'll have to leave that for our next show. Thank you so much for being a guest on the People Speak radio program today.
All right. Thank you for having me. I really had a lot of fun.
Bye, Arnie.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.